The final case set for argument this morning, State of South Dakota versus Richard Spry, appeal number 30787 and 788. Jan Heinrichs is present. He'll be arguing on behalf of the defendant appellant, and Renee Stelliger will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. With that, then, Mr. Heinrichs, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning. May it please the court, counsel. This appeal arises from convictions for grand theft and conspiracy based on the Spry's management of a joint bank account that was created under a valid power of attorney for Richard Hermanick, their relative, their beloved family member, in whose care they oversaw in good faith. The jury's verdict turned on Hermanick's intent and capacity at the time that the account was created. The circuit court's erroneous jury instructions and evidentiary exclusions prevented the jury from hearing critical evidence and applying the correct legal standard during their deliberations. We argue that there are three issues that require reversal of the convictions on counts one and two and a new trial on those counts. Number one, that the court refused a correct instruction on testamentary capacity and instead gave one limited to contractual capacity. Two, that the court excluded Mr. Hermanick's own statements made when he signed the joint account form, statements that directly reflected his existing intent. And then number three, that the court diminished the state's burden of proof, allowing it to rebut a criminal law presumption with only clear and convincing evidence instead of beyond a reasonable doubt.
So on your testamentary capacity instruction, the way I understand the argument is, and you proposed a testamentary capacity instruction. It was your number five, or I think your proposed instruction number five. So, and I think the argument, as I understand it, is, I mean, look, the judge just effectively foreclosed our gift theory, our lifetime gift theory, by instructing on the contract capacity, foreclosed us. We didn't have a shot.
Right.
Is your way of neutralizing what you claim to be an error giving just your instruction, or an instruction that allows the jury to make a determination as to whether this was a lifetime gift or whether it should be regarded as a bank account contract, and then apply the correct capacity test? Because the reason I ask is, forgive me while you're thinking about it, the reason I ask is if your argument is, no, we just think our instruction should have been given and not the contract one, then you're just flipping the error around. If your argument seems to be that the jury should have figured that one out factually, then applied the correct capacity, it almost seems like they should have been instructed on both theories.
I think under both proposals that the court is raising, I could be victorious, because if the court only ruled that it was a testamentary instrument, it would be based upon the circumstances surrounding it. The fact that these were his beloved relatives, his longtime caretakers, the fact that the document itself was testamentary in nature in that it's a joint account
agreement. Then the state would have the argument, of course they can't appeal versus an acquittal, but then the state would have the argument like, well, hey, then the judge foreclosed our contract theory.
I am open to the idea that if the court gives me a new jury trial, that we can have this discussion in front of the trial court. We propose the testamentary capacity instruction. They propose the contractual instrument instruction. The court chose between the two. I did not propose an instruction like one that the court is envisioning that allows the jury to decide which of these is which.
It seems like there's a factual question there. To sort of, if the court's inclined, or if the jury were inclined to sort of say, hey, look, Richard sort of said, you know, something, Susie, and mentioned, you know, Susan Spry's name or whatever, that there was, you know, your argument seems to be, hey, there was some evidence, at least, of sort of an assent and a gift theory, and we can do that. The state has a different view. Seems like there's a lurking in there. I know the capacity tests are different, but it seems like lurking within there is a corresponding factual question.
Since this wasn't an issue that was raised before the trial court and wasn't briefed, whether or not that would be the appropriate analysis to present to the jury, or the appropriate question to present to the to the jury is beyond my ken right now. What I can say, though, is that because the nature of the document, in my opinion, and the circumstances surrounding Mr. Hermanick's signing of it indicate that his testamentary capacity, I would be happy to make that argument to the jury, that not only is this... did he intend for this to happen, but that this is the correct standard that you should apply. The issue that I have with this, then, is it creates a two-level inquiry for the jury. Is it contractual, and is it testamentary? If it's contractual, this is the standard we have to apply. If it's testamentary, this is the standard we have to apply, and then that could cause confusion for the jury because you're instructing them to decide which analysis to apply based on a predicate question. But it would certainly be something that would have to be argued in a subsequent trial. The Mutual of Omaha account determined who owned the funds upon Mr. Hermanick's death. Under SDCL 29A6-104, sums in a joint account belong to the surviving parties unless rebutted. That is a dispositive post-mortem transfer, a testamentary act. South Dakota recognizes a lower threshold for testamentary capacity than for contractual capacity. Cases like Johnson v. Markvey and In re Estate of Pringle make this clear. Here, the witnesses explain that Mr. Hermanick understood and agreed that the account would pass to the surprise upon his death. By labeling the document strictly a contract, the circuit court foreclosed the jury's consideration of Mr. Hermanick's intent to make a post-death transfer and required a higher mental capacity threshold than what the law demands.
And he left the blank on the form, Mr. Hermanick, regarding survivorship unchecked. It's blank. The form itself. What language in the form itself creating a joint bank account leads you to the conclusion that there was a testamentary capacity? Is there any, or are you just relying on the testimony of the witnesses who, Way specifically, Levita Way, who presented the document to him?
I'm relying on the testimony of the witnesses.
So not on anything from the form itself?
Not from the form itself, but then, of course, there's a presumption under the law that I'm also relying on 29A6-104, but primarily upon the testimony of Levita Way and Susan Spry, that they each individually had explained to him what the consequences of this document were, that he indicated his understanding and his assent and that he signed off on it. And I think that that would be adequate under a testamentary capacity analysis. Because I don't want to get bogged down on just the one issue, if the court will indulge me, I'll move on to issue two.
Which is connected, actually.
Yes, it is.
That question, right? I mean, heck, you have more evidence of testamentary capacity if you win on two.
Witness Levita Way testified that after explaining the survivorship feature, Mr. Hermanick responded, and Susie, and then, which was his term for Susan Spry, the name by which he knew her and had used during their long familial association. He nodded, and then he reached for the pen. These were spontaneous, contemporaneous affirmations of his understanding and intent of what he was doing. There are two different grounds by which these verbal assents were admissible. The verbal acts doctrine, State v. Charger, statements accompanying an equivocal act are not hearsay. They explain the act's meaning. And then 1919-803-3, then existing state of mind, which admits statements of present intent or plan. The trial court excluded the testimony as hearsay, but under this court's decisions in Charger and Harris, verbal conduct accompanying a material act is not hearsay. Moreover, there were no findings that the statements were unnatural or suspicious. Instruction 25 told jurors that they must find clear and convincing evidence that Hermanick did not intend survivorship, but the best evidence, which is my issue three that we'll get to, but the best evidence of intent are Mr. Hermanick's own words. Is this what you want? Mm-hmm. The money will go to Richard and Susie. Mm-hmm. Susie. The jury did hear that he'd reached for the pen and nodded his head. I would argue, though, that his verbal assent, the verbal act of assenting, and that statement of what his intent was at the time that he executed the agreement.
So that's maybe better evidence for you if you get the verbal assent versus just the grabbing the pen, nodding his head.
Absolutely.
But does that get you to probably would have result in a different, in other words, prejudice, probably would have changed the result.
If I have the appropriate instruction on what the burden of proof is.
Do you think you have to have both to get to establish? You have to have both those errors to establish prejudice?
No, I don't think I do.
If you just get it on the evidentiary issue, you think that's enough to establish prejudice?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor, because there's a large difference between the jury hearing that he nodded his head and was handed it and took the pen and signed the document, as opposed to him nodding his head, uttering mm-hmm, in connection with nodding his head, a clear indicator of affirmation, and then saying the name Susie, his intended beneficiary of this joint account, after having been explained what would happen if he signed this document. That's a clear affirmation, much more clear, in my opinion, than just simply signing the document while nodding his head.
So the court seemed to place a lot of emphasis on the 803.3 exception. The state placed a lot of emphasis on the fact that, the survivorship statement wasn't checked, and so it didn't go to his intent. Seems like it could probably go to both. It seems like it go to his intent, but may have also gone to the fact that he was going to sign the agreement. So does that fall within the court's discretion if maybe it could have gone to intent, or it could have gone to something else, or if there's some basis to find it could have gone to intent, that's an abuse of discretion if the court didn't let it in?
Well, there's no evidence in the record that would indicate what else he could have been intending to do. He had been explained that this was what would happen if he signed this agreement. He nodded his hand. He nodded his head. He reached out for the pen. He uttered mm-hmm, a universal sign of affirmation, and said the name Susie. I don't know what else that would exhibit intent to do after having been explained what this document did. Not
so
once, but twice.
What the document says, you're saying he's responding to that question. Do you agree to that this money should go to Susie when you pass? And he says, Susie.
Yes.
It's hard, you know, with our evidentiary standard of review, which is an abuse of discretion, to, you know, look at those issues like we have here and sort of say, hey, where does discretion come in? Is the court obligated and really acting in sort of a preliminary factual finding role, right? I don't think it is that kind of a statement. And that's my basis under 803.3 for keeping it out. So operating within that deferential standard, how do we reverse on that?
Well, the court did make a factual error because the court said when the court was making its finding that Leveda Way had not explained anything about the document other than what Susan Spry had earlier told Mr. Hermanic, when in fact Leveda Way testified during her offer of proof that she did explain that this was a joint account agreement, and that if something were to happen to him, that it would pass to him. So I think when the court's ruling is based at least in part, in substantial part, on a mistake of fact under the evidence in the record, that would be enough for the court to find differently.
Can you remind me about your instruction on this is going to your third issue? Can you remind me of what instruction you might have proposed on this? You objected perhaps to the instruction as it was given, which contained the what I would call the civil law presumption, and then it had that paragraph at the end that said, but in any event, all these elements have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. What did you have as your optimal instruction here?
My instruction was similar, if not identical, except it contained the reasonable doubt standard in place of clear and convincing evidence and didn't have an explanation of what clear and convincing evidence required. And this is where I have to point out an error that I made in my brief. I cited to the wrong pages of the transcript when I discussed the discussions. The actual pages of the transcript where this instruction was discussed and my objections were overruled is pages 471 and 472. But basically, I asked the court to make the overcoming of the presumption that this is what was intended to occur when this document signed a beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Well, the instruction we've got is, I guess, whatever it is and whatever you've proposed. But it occurred to me while I was looking at that instruction that it's kind of taking a civil law concept and sort of applying this presumption, and then there's this weird rebut under clear and convincing evidence thing. the presumption that really would apply in a criminal context, it seems to me, is just the presumption of innocence.
Yes.
It applies throughout. It pervades every element of this offense.
Yes.
And the only way you rebut that or prove that is beyond proof, a proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So do you even need that presumption? Because the clear and convincing standard subsumed within reasonable doubt, the presumption doesn't really mean much because the defendant is presumed innocent of everything anyway.
I think it's helpful for the jury to be advised that there's a specific legal presumption for this type of act or conduct. And there are a handful of other places. My time is up. May I finish responding to your question? There are a handful of other places in the criminal law where there are presumptions. For example, 32.23.7, which is the presumptions when it comes to under the influence based upon blood alcohol content. There's the presumption that the defense has in order to present the defense of insanity. So there are other occasions when one party or the other will have the benefit of a presumption on a specific discrete transaction or fact that's an issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dellinger, you may proceed with argument.
May it please the court and counsel. This appeal concerns the Spry's conviction for grand theft and conspiracy to commit grand theft regarding the Mutual of Omaha bank account. We are not here to settle someone's estate. In 2018, a bank account with the Mutual of Omaha Bank was opened between Susan and Richard Spry and Richard Hermanick. Susan testified that she told Hermanick she opened the account and was going to move his money from his Tyndall Bank account into this Mutual of Omaha Bank account for convenience, so she would have easy access to pay his bills as she was his power of attorney. She also testified that she did not expect there to be money left over in that account when Hermanick died. To open the account, contractual intent was required. Because it was a contract between those three parties and the bank, it is a contract that requires contractual intent. The jury was instructed that they had the responsibility of determining whether Hermanick had contractual intent to open the Mutual of Omaha bank account.
So was the jury, let me ask this. So is the gift theory, the lifetime gift theory in lieu of a testamentary gift, that theory, is that absolutely precluded? Could not have gone there, even legally, not just factually here, just because this was a contract, because this was an account that required a contract, mm-hmm. We were never going to go there, couldn't go there. It was only ever going to be a contract theory?
Correct. It was only a contract. If Hermanick would have intended it to have the rights of survivorship and the money would have avoided probate, it still would not have been required testamentary intent. Contractual intent is required to open this contract, this bank account, no matter what. So, yes, contractual intent is always required to open a bank account.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, right. So, but he couldn't. So the defendants couldn't defend then on the basis that, well, he signed, but he really meant the joint tenancy, and I know it was left blank, but put that off to the side. So, but he really meant this to be a gift in the event that there was any money left over. It was supposed to go to Susie or whatever. So they couldn't make that argument at all?
Correct, Your Honor. Even if he would have intended it to have the rights of survivorship and been a quote-unquote gift at the end of the day, it still is a contract between a bank and a group of three people.
Okay.
And contractual intent is required to open a bank account.
Counsel, can you address instruction number 25?
Mm-hmm.
We have reference to two burdens of proof with reference to the rebuttable presumption, the clear and convincing standard, and then reference to beyond a reasonable doubt, both used in the same instruction. Is that a problem for the state? If not, why not?
No, that is not a problem for the state. Instruction 25 properly instructed the jury that joint bank accounts have a rebuttable presumption, and that presumption can be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. As was alluded to, this instruction, that part might not have even been needed. However, it is correct. A joint bank account, because it has the right of survivorship, that can only become be overcome by clear and convincing evidence pursuant to statute.
It is kind of an awkward instruction to apply for a jury when you have the two different burdens of proof there. And I think, I don't know if you just said that part maybe wasn't needed, the clear and convincing. Is that?
I think it is needed. I think because the legislator decided that joint bank accounts have this rebuttable presumption, that the jury needed to be instructed how to overcome that rebuttable presumption.
So then what was the difference between that determination and then the beyond a reasonable doubt element that had to be proved that he did not have the authority to use those funds or access those funds?
Correct. The elements, as this court has repeatedly held most recently, I believe in the Pfeiffer case, that juries have the burden of establishing elements beyond a reasonable doubt, not presumptions. So first the jury had to overcome that presumption, and then they had to find the elements beyond a reasonable doubt.
Even if the presumption and one of the elements sound a lot the same?
Yeah, it's presumed that juries can follow instructions, and this is clear. Because it's a joint bank account, it has that rebuttable presumption, and to overcome that presumption, clear and convincing evidence is needed.
So the state had to, right, so the state had to overcome the presumption of clear and convincing evidence. Mm-hmm. But along the way, they also had to prove that the defendants appropriated the money beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
Did that sort of envelop the presumption?
No.
So the presumption really is when they go into a criminal trial, he's not guilty of anything. Mm-hmm. She's not guilty of anything. Mm-hmm. That's the presumption. So in the course of sort of rebutting this presumption that it really was a joint tenancy with right of survivorship and therefore not appropriation, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the course of doing that, the state's going to necessarily, if they win, they're going to necessarily have to prove not just that presumption is gone, but that they appropriated, that's the element, that they appropriated the money. And then it's at a heightened standard of proof. So kind of having a hard time understanding how that just doesn't kind of collapse into this larger context of a criminal trial.
Yes,
maybe I'm wrong. Looks like everybody had the presumption in their instruction, so maybe that's the way it is.
Yeah. And in fact, the defense in this case did have two proposed jury instructions, one with that clear and convincing and one without the clear and convincing. So they did have one that did have clear and convincing evidence.
Well, yeah. if anything, the state kind of had to prove it twice, right?
Correct.
But first rebut the presumption, and then they'd prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the elements. You actually, according to the instruction, had to jump over two hurdles to get to prove up your case. So then the only argument really is, did it confuse the jury? You know, did the jury get confused because they thought, well, what's our burden here? Is it clear and convincing? Is it beyond a reasonable doubt? You know, what's the burden of proof we have to apply to convict the defendant? And probably within the court's discretion to decide that, assuming it's not an error of law. Not very clear, though, to me.
Sure. I believe it is clear to the jury, and you're correct. The state had the burden of jumping over basically two hurdles. This first hurdle of the rebuttable presumption by clear and convincing, and then all of the elements by reasonable doubt.
What about the... go ahead, please. About the 8033 issue?
So moving on to the hearsay issue.
Is the judge's factual mistake about who said what and how it was represented, is that problematic for that ruling?
No, I don't believe so. Under 8033, the court held that the statements would have been made to prove a belief of what Hermanic said, what he was signing, and why he wanted to sign it. So the second part of 8033, where it says a statement of belief to prove a fact belief, that is what the circuit court found that Hermanic statements were alluding to.
But the memory or belief to prove a fact remembered or believed seems like something different than the particular act that's happening at that time in a statement that relates to that particular act. So how is the at the time that he's being handed with the nod What is the memory or belief of a fact remembered?
But Susie already explained this to him. She had a phone call, actually several phone calls, explaining to him why she was opening the bank account and why she was moving the money. So her manic statements were referring to the fact that he was already explained this by Susan or Susie. If he was instead of referring to the rights of survivorship, it would have made sense for him to refer to Susie and Richard, his biological kin. So the court held that instead of referring to his intent at the time, he was referring to what he was signing in a belief remembered.
Biological nephew.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. That seems more weighty than admissibility-y, doesn't it?
Will you explain that, please?
Yeah, it seems like it goes more to weight than admissibility. He only mentioned Susie and not Richard. Okay. Why would that preclude admission?
The circuit court found that also because the form was left blank regarding his intent, that it was his statements were not referring to his intent at that time. If this court finds that the circuit court abused its discretion by making a decision clearly against reason or evidence, then prejudice must be looked at. And there was no prejudice in this case because Way and Brenton both testified as to his intent when he signed it. Brenton was not physically there when he signed it, but he came back into the room afterwards and he testified that he had experience dealing with elderly individuals and he believed that Hermanick had the intent needed to sign that agreement.
How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that the verbal statements of Hermanick would have carried great weight with the jury?
I disagree with that, especially because if he only referred to Susie, it makes more sense for him to refer to Susie and Richard, if that's who he expected to get the money when he died. He was also explained by Susie that he would not have money in this account when he died. So Susie told him that she did not believe he would have money. We don't know what he believed, if he thought there would be money left or not. But Susie did tell him there would be no money left. So presumably he would also believe there would be no money in that account. So there would be no place for the money to go.
Aren't you reading a lot into those statements, though? I mean, you're presenting an assumption of what you think he meant by saying Susie. Mm-hmm. One word. Who knows? You know, especially if he had some cognitive deficits, what he was referring to there, mm-hmm. As opposed to the nod. You know, there is some distinction there, but you know, and typically where I've seen that type of a exclusion based on that rule, it's where you have an actual statement, like what you said. You know, if he nodded and said, "Oh yeah, Susie." You know, a month ago or whatever told me about this, and this is what I agreed to. Okay, so there's your fact and memory, the statement that you're referring back to, and that's not admissible under that statute. So I don't know. Do you have any response? But you think you can glean that just from the word Susie here?
The circuit court had the ability to look at all of the facts present and all of the evidence and make its determination. And it's this court's job to determine if it abused its discretion. It's hard to know what he meant when he said that statement. And I think it's kind of confusing. It could have confused the jury at the end of the day to that statement and been kept out under 403, presumably, if it was overly confusing to the jury. It's not the state's position. It should have been kept over 403, but it could have been if that's what the circuit court decided.
Wasn't so unequivocal that it's easy to make the decision regarding admission about an expression of intent. It wasn't so clear.
Correct.
That's where the discretion comes in under mm-hmm. our standard.
If the court does not have any further questions, the state would rely on its brief and give its closing section. In closing, because the Mutual of Omaha was a joint account, it had the presumption of the right of survivorship. The jury was properly instructed on the burden needed to overcome that presumption, which was clear and convincing evidence. Hermanick merely intended the Mutual of Omaha bank account for its own benefit or convenience and not for the benefit of the Spries. Evidence in the trial by Brenton, who was the Spry's own son, was that Hermanick loved all of his nieces and nephews. He had approximately 10 nieces and nephews, and he Brenton testified that Hermanick treated everyone alike and did not favor any family members. Betty Merritt, who was a niece of Hermanick, testified that Hermanick always told his nieces and nephews that his money would go to all of his family members. And finally, Susan testified that the purpose of the joint bank account was to grant her easy access to pay Hermanick's bills. When Hermanick signed the Mutual of Omaha bank account, he said the statement of Susie, yes, and mm-hmm. The circuit court excluded the statement because it found it was inadmissible hearsay. If this court finds that the circuit court abused its discretion in that decision, the Spries were not prejudiced by that statement's exclusion because other testimony showed Hermanick's mental dexterity at that time and his intent, and that evidence was admitted without objection. Because there are no further questions, the state would rely on its brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Heinrichs, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you. A few things that I would like to address directly. With regard to the Attorney General's comments regarding this joint account agreement, that it's contractual in nature. It's a contract between Mr. Hermanick, the Spries, and the bank, and her references to Ms. Spry's intent. What controls here is Mr. Hermanick's intent. And Mr. Hermanick's intent, based upon the testimony of Brenton Spry, Leveda Way, Susan Spry, Attorney Rothschädel, who did his POA, was that this was his intent. There was enough evidence there, particularly if his verbal assent to the contract and its contents, that this was a testamentary wish on his part and that we should have been allowed to present that to the jury. But to refer to Susan Spry's intent, that this was for her convenience, I think is a red herring, because what controls is what Mr. Hermanick's intent was, and that's how it should be decided by the jury. With regard to the state's position that the Spries were not prejudiced because of this difference in the presumptions, clear and convincing, in order to rebut the presumption that this was a right, there was a right of survivorship, and then reasonable doubt on the elements in general, that therefore the state had to prove their case twice. I respectfully disagree. And the reason why is because this is a case where the essential elements specifically say the defendant took or exercised unauthorized control over money. That's element one in instruction number 11. In instruction number three, the defendant took or exercised unauthorized control over the money with the intent to deprive the owner thereof. If the jury rebuts the legal presumption that this was an account with a right of survivorship by clear and convincing evidence, they no longer need to address the unauthorized. They've already settled that issue. They've already resolved it. If the 12 of them get together and say, yeah, I think there was clear and convincing evidence that there's no right of survivorship here, they can't go back and say, but it's still unauthorized. Under what logic would that operate? We do presume the jurors will follow instructions, but we also presume that they will act logically and rationally.
So the state rebuts the presumption. We're a bursting bubble presumption state, so it's gone. Parties are back on an equal footing. Not an equal footing, because the state's the only one with a burden, but there's no presumption. It's gone. And now the state has to prove appropriation as an element, notwithstanding presumptions of survivorship. The state has to prove appropriation as an element beyond reasonable doubt. So I'm not sure I understand your argument that posits that if they rebut the presumption, it's over.
If they rebut the presumption by clear and convincing evidence that this was a right of survivorship, then they've in fact found that this was unauthorized control. And so there would be no rational reason for them to then apply a higher standard to a question that they've already answered pursuant to the court's instructions.
Because that was the only theory of appropriation.
Correct.
Yeah.
For these two counts, that was the only theory of appropriation. And so basically the jury was instructed by the court to find whether or not unauthorized control occurred by clear and convincing evidence. And that is contrary to the due process clause and their rights.
How would your instruction have fixed that error that you're asserting?
The instruction would have instructed the jury that there is a presumption of a right of survivorship. Therefore, control is authorized unless the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not unauthorized and that this was not.
And you don't mention clear and convincing at all in your instruction?
My proposed instruction did not mention clear and convincing.
Did the state argue it that way? The way the instruction read, did they make an argument to the jury that you have to find this by clear and convincing evidence, rebut the presumption, and then didn't argue anything else? I mean, do you think it was used in that fashion when it was argued to the jury?
In all candor, my recollection is that they did discuss the instruction with the jury, to what extent they argued it. But again, my argument, in the event that you go back and look at the record and that they didn't argue it vigorously or highlight it, I would still argue, though, that the fact that it's an instruction and the jurors are presumed to follow instructions, that means that it did. If I may just, I know my time is up. May I close very briefly?
Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The Spries were not accused of theft in the ordinary sense, but of acting under an allegedly unauthorized legal arrangement. Determining authorization demanded the correct capacity standard, the decedent's own explanation, and the proper criminal burden of proof. And the defendants were denied all three of those circumstances. I would ask the court to reverse the convictions on counts 1 and 2. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.